Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro. And this week, my guest is the co-founder and CEO of Rogue Amoeba Software, Paul Kafafis. Paul, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
Hey, thank you for joining me on the show.
Thank you for having me. Absolutely.
I've been a big fan of your products. In fact, I want the listeners to know that I'm currently using Audio Hijack and I'm using Loopback. And if necessary, I may have to use a wonderful app called Fission to edit the M4A file afterwards. So we're kind of up to our ears here in Rogue Amoeba stuff.
Well, we're always glad to hear that.
Yeah. I don't know what I would do without you guys. So tell me, how did all this get started? What were you doing before Rogue Amoeba? And how did you get to be so good with audio?
I usually say that we fell into this. It was not anything that we really had a plan for, and over time it became clear that audio was the niche that we had some talent in, and it sort of grew from there.
When you say we, who is we?
So myself and two co-founders, Alex Lagudin and Quentin Carnicelli, founded the company back in almost 14 years ago, 2002. So we've been doing this for just short of a decade and a half, and enjoying working in the audio space for that period.
What were you doing just before you met those guys?
The three of us actually were working on some MP3 playing software prior to this at another small company called Subband, and we were working on one of the previously we'd worked on MacAmp, which was the first MP3 player on the Mac. This was before iTunes, obviously, and before SoundJam, which is what became iTunes, and even before Audion, which is what was Panic Software's MP3 player. So we had some good experience dealing with audio files and digital audio files right as that was sort of coming into the forefront, or not even the forefront, but sort of coming into view for people, where they realized, hey, my computer can play music, and it can play music that sounds as good or better than what I hear on the radio. So the three of us had been working together on an MP3 player called MacAmp, and on OS X we'd been working on MacAmp Lite for OS X, which was at that time competing with iTunes, which was not a great place to be. And on the side we were doing some other audio work, and that ultimately led us to create our first product, which was Audio Hijack 1, which you mentioned using, a tool for recording audio. Mm-hmm. And from there, we founded the new company and have grown ever since.
How did you decide on the word, the company name, Rogue Amoeba? It's fascinating. It sounds cool. It sounds like this squirrely little creature that goes around chomping on other little amoeba.
Right. It's definitely a little. It sticks in your head. It's a name that is memorable and a little, certainly not even a little different. Very different. I always say I wish we had a better story for this. That there was some sort of very good explanation for this. The truth is that we were bickering over names because our product itself was ready to ship, and we had our website pretty much done, except we needed to fill in the company name, and the product itself was pretty much ready to go, except we needed to have the company's name on there. And we were sort of dickering back and forth with various names, and ultimately we had the idea of an adjective and a noun, and we were talking about Rogue Butterfly, which was based on a joke from The Simpsons from about 20 years ago. And if anyone remembers that joke, I'll be very impressed. I'm sure a few listeners will, but we somehow morphed from that to Rogue Amoeba.
Is this the butterfly in New Orleans that causes the floods in Maine?
It's not, although that's a good guess. There's actually, I'll spoil it for anybody. It's Bart envisions himself, I believe, setting the school on fire, and he is for some reason a butterfly. And his line at the end of it is because no one ever suspects a butterfly. It was a very odd joke, and it sticks in my head, obviously, because it led to all of this, or it sort of led to this name anyway. But like I said, I wish we had a better name, a better explanation for the name. And honestly, I wish we'd chosen something that people could spell better, because people there's multiple ways to spell the word amoeba, and people spell it about two or three different correct ways, along with multiple incorrect ways. And then no one can spell the word rogue. We get a whole lot of... So we have, over the years, owned several different domain names that point back to the site. And fortunately for us, Google is pretty good about correcting people's spelling. But if I had one piece of advice for people coming up with a name, it would be, obviously, you want to be able to get the .com domain name. That was true 14 years ago. It's true now. But you also want something that people are going to be able to spell and not have to purchase two, three, four different domain names.
Well, it's so charming that they want to learn how to spell it. How's that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So Audio Hijack was the first product, and I remember coming in on the Audio Hijack 2 phase and using it for small things, especially for Apple's quarterly reports where I needed to record the Safari audio coming from Apple and having a transcript and things like that.
Right, absolutely.
So that was the first product.
So Audio Hijack 1.0 came out in September, I think it was September 30th of 2002. And then about 6 months later, we had been working on what was planned to be version 2. But we realized that we had gotten a whole lot of feedback from people and we'd added a whole lot of features. And we said, all right, this is actually not version 2. This is a new product. And that was actually what became Audio Hijack Pro. And that, for many years, was our most popular product, was Audio Hijack Pro. And we had both Audio Hijack and Audio Hijack Pro. And it was sort of, it was a bit confusing for people because, you know, your average user doesn't necessarily think that they need the, quote, pro version of something. Mm-hmm. And the pro in there didn't really mean this is for studio professionals. It meant this is sort of a more featureful, more advanced version. But it was really the version everybody should have been using. So after, let's see, in 2015 is when we came out with Audio Hijack 3. So after about 12 years, we finally cleared up the name confusion and brought it back down to just one product with it, which is currently Audio Hijack 3.
Did you get any pushback or confusion about the loss of the term pro in the name?
Very little, actually. I think we dealt with a lot of confusion about the inclusion of the suffix pro for a long time. And like I said, people would say, oh, you know, I'm just using this at home. I don't need the pro version. We'd say, no, you know, that's not really what that means. So that's probably the version you want. It's got all the features you're going to want. And so now that we just have Audio Hijack 3, it's been pretty straightforward, I think. And the best thing that we did was version 3 was a paid upgrade, but we said, any previous version of Audio Hijack, whether it was Audio Hijack 1, Audio Hijack 2, Audio Hijack Pro 1, Audio Hijack Pro 2, they all get the same upgrade price to version 3. And so, you know, if you had an older version and you want to use the latest Audio Hijack, this is it. This is the one you want. So that was sort of our way of hoping to clear this up, and it's gone pretty well, I think.
One of the things that Jeff Gammon and I love about, and I'm sure the other editors at the Mac Observer, we love is this data flow image or chart in Audio Hijack 3, where you have modules and you connect these modules like Lego bricks, and they flow into an output device like the headphones, and then they flow into your recorder where you see real-time counter of file size and time. And when the data flow is active, you see the line light up as visual confirmation. This is just awesome user interface, user experience. And it is just light years ahead of what was happening in Audio Hijack 2. How did you come around to that? Was it a slow thing? Did you have another app that inspired you? What was the origin of that?
I think there's not one, you know, simple answer that says this was it and you know, we had a eureka moment. I think it was more, there's this sort of chain of blocks is something that's out there in a few sort of more professional apps. There's an app called Quartz Composer that Apple makes, which does actions in a sequence and you see them flow, you know, one to the next one, just like you're describing in Audio Hijack. But it's not something we'd really seen in terms of audio anywhere else. And the closest we came actually was sort of the effects grid, which used to be in the previous version of Audio Hijack. And those effects were blocks that took audio in and they applied some effect to the audio. And so you have a 10-band equalizer that adjusts the audio or whatever. And they would flow left to right, and it was something where people understood the basics of what was happening, but it wasn't what we have now, it didn't show the actual visual flow as you've described. It didn't show the audio actually flowing through and being adjusted. And so that was sort of where we started, at least. And we said, all right, this is, you know, audio is something you only hear, and there's no simple visual representation of audio. I mean, there's a waveform, but there's not anything that...
But there can be a visual representation of the fact that data is flowing in the right direction.
And that's exactly where we got to, exactly. So we said, you know, how can we show users that what they expect to happen is happening, or maybe right. what, you know, something they don't expect is happening, and we want that to be clear to them. So if there's no activity in those pipes, in those lines, then something is up and no audio is flowing, and maybe you need to check your settings. Or, you know, if it's only going to some of the blocks, then you might need to check that you've turned off one of the blocks such that the audio doesn't flow that direction. And it was really, it was something where we said, you know, I think this is a good way for users to better understand how the audio is moving through the system and, you know, visually show it. It was something that you asked, you know, sort of how long it took us. It was something that we had the idea, oh, geez, I'd be embarrassed to actually figure it out, but several years before we finally released Audio Hijack 3, and we had, you know, prototypes working, and we could tell that it was superior to what we had. And that's always a good feeling. You know, you're working on something new, and you can say, this is better, and this is going to be great, and we want our users to get this as soon as possible. But the problem is you've actually got to finish it, and you've got to polish it, and you've got to get it to the point where the user will actually be able to make full use of it. And that took, you know, several years, and was certainly frustrating to be able to say, you know, here's the current version. It's not, in our minds, we would say it's not great, but it works. But we know very soon we're going to have something that's so much better, and we really want to get that to you. So it was a good incentive to keep working, but it was also definitely a little frustrating in that it took us, you know, several years to get to where we wanted to be.
Is there a technical name that you provide to that data train in yellow, or the snake or the train, or?
Just the audio pipeline.
Okay.
I usually think of it as sort of a plumbing metaphor where, you know, water flows through tubes and you can see that it's going up to the second floor or down to the basement, things like that. Mm-hmm. That's sort of how I picture it. But so pipeline is the word that we use for it.
Now, it's one thing to grab the sound in OS X, soon Mac OS, from, say, Safari. It's another thing to integrate multiple different input sources and lay them down on the same audio track. And for that, for a long time, as I understand it, and I'm still a newbie at this, is we use the thing called SoundFlower, which allowed us to integrate different sources. SoundFlower always seemed kind of problematic to me, seemed to be kind of a source of instability on my Mac. And so walk us through how SoundFlower works and what the problems were with it and what inspired you to do a formal replacement called Loopback.
Right, absolutely. So SoundFlower was an open source tool, is an open source tool. It's still around, but it was an open source tool that was created by a guy named Matt Ingles. And it's a tool that got a lot of use, but as you said, had definitely caused a lot of issues for people, or, you know, caused a lot of frustration for people. It was basically a tool to route audio between applications. So if you're taking audio from QuickTime Player and you want to get it into Skype so that both you and the other party can hear it, if you want to play a soundbite or a music clip or things like that. All sorts of different examples.
Which we're going to do in a few minutes.
There you go.
Okay.
So all sorts of different examples for how you want to pipe audio between applications that don't by default take audio in from anything but a microphone. And SoundFlower basically creates these virtual audio devices that let you pass audio between applications. And it was a tool that we saw a whole lot of people using with Audio Hijack and Audio Hijack Pro with our recording tools. And it was a tool that we saw a whole lot of people having various issues with and various frustrations with. And it was something that we did not have a whole lot of control over, as it was an open source product. And for a brief period, the previous developers had said, you know what, we're not developing it any longer. And we sort of took it under our wing and said, all right, we'll at least try and keep it working on the latest OS. But ultimately, even that, because it was not our code base, because it was not something that we had much familiarity with, it was not something that was really viable. And we sort of handed it back to the community and said, all right, you know, this works and we've kept it working. But as far as improvements to it go, it's simply not something that we have the resources to devote to it. And it's something where sort of the foundation that was there, it's incredibly cool, but it's not something that is, I don't want to critique it too much, but it's something that has a lot of issues. And we wanted to start with something fresh. And we said, all right, we've got a lot of the backend technology to replicate this and to turn it into a product that people can actually rely on. And that's really what it was with Loopback.
And that's what you've done.
Was making a tool that people like you could rely on and say, you know what, I create a podcast, and for a lot of people, it's hopefully a source of at least some side income, or, you know, at least a source of enjoyment, and they want to have something that's not causing them frustration. And so Loopback was something that we put together with the technology that we had, and we said, all right, you know, we know somewhat how people are using Soundflower, and we'll cover those use cases, and we'll also cover some other things that it, you know, hasn't previously handled, just in terms of grabbing audio from applications and bringing them together, and in terms of the interface as well, because the interface in Loopback is designed to be a lot simpler to grasp than what was available with Soundflower. So I think it was just something where there was a tool that did something and was useful, but had plenty of issues and continues to have issues that make it not so accessible for a whole lot of people. And if you're somebody who's deeply into audio and you want to fiddle with this stuff and you want to, you know, break things and fix them and take pleasure in that, absolutely, Soundflower is a great tool for that. But if you're somebody who's looking for a solution that, you know, with a few clicks will get you set and hopefully will work and will continue to work for months without needing any adjustments, that's really what we made Loopback for.
Thank you for making that. It made my life better.
We love to hear that as well. So we're very glad to help out, obviously.
All right. So back to Audio Hijack. You were very gracious in sending me a license. So I've lost track of whether it's in the Mac App Store.
No. So
I doubt that it is. I'm trying to remember, were we having a discussion earlier about the difficulties in the Mac App Store with an app like Audio Hijack?
If we weren't, I have certainly had that discussion with many people over the years. So yeah, Audio Hijack is sold directly from our website exclusively. It's not something that we can get into the Mac App Store. I don't know. I'm sure you're pretty familiar with the rules and restrictions that Apple has for their Mac App Store, and probably most listeners are at least somewhat familiar with it. But I think it's something where it's not necessarily obvious to everyone. The Mac App Store seems like this great thing, and you know, you open it on your Mac and you search for a tool and you find it and you download it and it's right there. You've paid for it with just a couple clicks. And the idea of it is great, but the implementation has definitely some issues for developers who are doing things that are not necessarily, you know, something simple like a text editor or, you know, a more rudimentary tool that doesn't necessarily have to do things that Apple doesn't apparently want to allow in their App Store. So
if you just for the record, if you had to name a couple of things that are notable that keeps Audio Hijack from being in the Mac App Store, what would they be?
Right, absolutely. So, I mean, the biggest one currently is sandboxing. So after the Mac App Store came out, later Apple made it such that apps had to be sandboxed. And that basically means that they can't talk to other apps openly. You can create a way to talk to another app, and that other app has to implement that same thing. And I'm sort of glossing over this, but that's sort of the gist of it, is that you no longer have free access to talk to other applications and to get things from them. And in our case, that means getting audio from those applications. So sandboxing is the big one. Another thing that we have is a tool called Instant On, which is sort of an extra that we include in Audio Hijack, and it basically makes audio capture work better. So by default, most audio capture works, but if you want things to work as smoothly as possible, you should install this Instant On extra. And that requires administrative privileges. And in the Mac App Store, you can't install anything additional to your application. So those are just two quick things that, you know, immediately disqualify us from being in there and just make it a non-starter, really.
Has that, in your mind, been an impediment to sales, or is Audio Hijack? I assume Audio Hijack is so famous and so beloved and so useful that not being in the Mac App Store in this case probably hasn't affected you. Would that be right?
Well, it's obviously difficult to say because we haven't been there and then, you know, lost it, but it's certainly something where for the Mac App Store started in, was it 2010, I think? So 6 years ago, I think, was the Mac App Store. So for the first 8 years of the company, there was no Mac App Store, and we were selling software directly from our website, and people were downloading it and purchasing it right through our store. And it was not something that we had any issues with. And, you know, we were able to start this company and grow it to having employees. And, you know, so we were certainly doing well before the Mac App Store. Since the Mac App Store came out, it's not something where we've said, oh, this is, we can tell this is negatively impacting us, in part because there's not a whole lot of competition for Audio Hijack in the first place. As you said, it's pretty well known, and it's, I think, sort of the standard for audio capture on the Mac, and whatever else might be out there can't really get in the Mac App Store either. So, the biggest issue is just if someone gets a Mac and says, okay, I need some software, and they go to the Mac App Store and they think that's the only place to get software. But I think in the past couple of years, we've seen a whole lot of fairly high profile apps leave the Mac App Store. And I think that's led to people realizing that there's software out there that they can't get from the store.
I've had a few developers on the show who have done that exact same thing. All right. Well, there's lots more to talk about, but I think this is a good time to take a break and do one of those fabulous things that we were talking about before, and that is integrating sound from another device. So we're going to do a short commercial here. It's only 60 seconds. Folks, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we are back. Thanks, Kelly. I am chatting with Paul Kafafis from Rogue Amiga Software. Paul, you were talking about restrictions in the Mac App Store before the break. Tell me about what you've learned so far from Mac OS Sierra, because Apple continues the security clampdown in OS X/Mac OS. Have there been any notable problems you've seen in the betas?
Well, there's one big issue right now, which is that when you download software and it's in a zip file, which is how a whole lot of independently distributed software is distributed, Apple does some work on the back end. It's invisible to the user, but what they're doing is designed to sort of lock off the application until the user has used it enough that they say, okay, this is something that the user trusts. But the downside to what they're doing is that it's breaking some facets of a whole lot of software out there, including software updating. So there's a
tool called this. What is the term that Apple refers to?
There's a couple different names. It's app translocation or gatekeeper path randomization. Right. And basically, it's putting the application on a read-only disk image, invisible to the user, and running the application from there. And the idea is that it will prevent vulnerable applications from being manipulated by outside parties.
Having the resources switched out behind the scenes.
Exactly. Yeah. So the application can no longer load external resources, which there was an issue noted about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, and this works around that. The problem is what they're doing right now, at least in the betas, is it's going a little too far, and it's impacting a whole lot of software that is not vulnerable at all. So we're currently, we've written about this and we've talked to other developers about this, and we're hoping that Apple will make some adjustments to make this a little less impactful for that software that's not vulnerable. But by and large, the Sierra update, the 10.12 update, is looking pretty good. It doesn't have any major issues for us, and we're certainly looking at having our software up to date once it ships in the fall, and if not earlier, when the public beta happens at some point this month. So,
cool. Well, we've talked about Audio Hijack and we've talked about Loopback. Now I want to talk about this other fabulous app that you developed rather recently called Fission, One of the things I discovered is that I was not able to edit my compressed .m4a files with GarageBand. And that was annoying. And then out of the blue, you guys delivered on a really cool product called Fission. Tell us about that.
Well, so Fission is our audio editor. So we had Audio Hijack, and it was letting people record audio. And people would say, hey, this is great. I got the file that I wanted, but, you know, I recorded too much, or there was someone misspoke, and I wanted to cut that out, or, you know, basic simple editing that people want to do. And for years, we sent them to various editors that are out there. But eventually, we said, you know, this is silly. We have all these customers who need an audio editor. We should make an audio editor. And that's ultimately what we did. You mentioned GarageBand, which is something that a lot of people use for their editing, as it's included with a whole lot of Macs. Fission is a little bit different from GarageBand in that it works with compressed audio. So you mentioned M4A files, AAC files, which are compressed audio files, and just like MP3 files are compressed down. And Fission is actually capable of working inside of those compressed formats. So if you have an MP3 file or an AAC file, you can edit it with Fission and not have to re-encode the audio, not have to decode and re-encode the audio before and after you're editing.
Do you decompress on the fly in bits and pieces, or do you decompress the whole thing and then write it back out?
No, so there's actually no decompression done at all. So Fission is working inside the compressed audio. So what we call lossless editing. So when you record to AAC or MP3, there's some quality loss for, you know, spoken word like this podcast. It'll still sound phenomenal, but you know, for high end music, you'll hear a little bit of quality loss. And with Fission, we're editing right inside that compressed file, so that there's no additional quality loss when you make an edit. When you use something go ahead.
Was that a really hard thing to do?
It is. That's my co-founder Alex did the back end work to enable us to do that, and it's pretty magical. It's something that it's a feature that we tout for the application. It's something that not necessarily everybody even really understands or appreciates, but ultimately you wind up with a file that does not lose any quality, so it sounds better than it would if you edited it with something other than Fission. So I think it's something that a lot of people may not even realize is happening, but the result is good. So we're pretty happy with that.
I'm pretty happy with it too. Okay, so we've covered the major apps from Rogue Amoeba. One of the things I like to ask the developers is, how are you feeling these days about being an Apple developer? Are things getting better, easier? I know you want to be careful what you say, but go ahead, lay it on us.
Well, it's interesting for us because, you know, we're not in the Mac App Store. We have one application in there. Fission is in the Mac App Store, but that's the only application of ours that we can get in there, and the rest of our software is not, and we don't have a whole lot on iOS. So it's not something where we're too concerned about holding back or... So the answer to your question is, it's complicated. It's something where in the early 2000s when we started, OS X was, I don't think we were ever on 10.0, but we were on 10.1, which was really the first version of OS X that was workable. And, 10.2 and 10.3 and all these updates came out just about every year for a brief period, a little longer than that. But, you know, the software has gotten better over time, and the hardware has gotten phenomenal in terms of the laptops and the popularity that we've seen of Macs in the world, just walking around, you know, being at the airport or being at a conference that's tech related in any way, you'll see tons of MacBooks and MacBook Airs. So on the one hand, Apple's sales are way up, and, you know, in the past 10 years, we've seen millions of new Mac users, which is a good thing. On the other hand, it's a little bit of a different platform than it was 10, 15 years ago when we got started, in that you mentioned, you know, Apple's really locking things down as far as security goes, and they're doing that for the user's benefit to make sure that, you know, bad things don't happen to their computer. But it has an impact on developers as well in terms of what we're able to do and how much work it takes to do the things that we want to do and we want to provide to users. So I think it's something where, we were very happy early on the platform when we had any success because we didn't necessarily expect anything. And over time, this turned into a real business and turned into full-time jobs for 10 people that work here. And as that happened concurrently, Apple was growing to be this enormous company, you know, one of the biggest companies in the world. And so it's sort of, things have shifted quite a bit. And then obviously the thing that I haven't mentioned is iOS, the iPhone and the iOS platform has obviously become a huge focus for Apple. And to the point where at times the Mac has seemed a little, not necessarily ignored, but certainly not as important to them.
Mm-hmm. And you're not the only one who feels that.
That started. So it's a little different for us.
Yes. Well, one of the things that happens to me, not so often, but happens to others I know of, is that audio on the Mac always seems a little flaky. For some reason, there's always some little thing going on. I remember, I think it was before 10.11.5, I would just lose audio altogether. It'd be gone. And if I went into the system preferences and changed the volume just a smidgen,
it'd come right back.
Then I got my audio right back. And I haven't been having that problem lately. I think maybe it got fixed in 10.11.5. I'm not sure. But there's always something, you know, some little gotcha going on with Apple and audio. Do you have anything to tell us about why that might be from a system standpoint?
Well, I mean, there's certainly not one simple answer like Apple doesn't get audio or anything like that. I mean, they understand audio, and audio has been a big part of the Mac experience for a long time. And, you know, with things like GarageBand and tools like that, that it's clear that Apple is interested in audio, and it's used in all kinds of studios. Their hardware is. So I think part of it is that it's a difficult thing to deal with, and it's an easy thing to have a problem with, because so many people are using audio, and it's very obvious when something goes wrong, because you're listening to music and suddenly the music stops, or suddenly the music drops out.
Like iTunes, where it just pauses for a second.
Right. And so it's something where if you have an issue with saving a file to the disk, you'll probably never even notice it. There'll be a quick pause and you won't even notice, and then the file will get saved and, you know, you won't even see that it happened. Whereas with audio, it's obvious that you've heard that there's an issue. I think the other issue that we've seen, not just related to audio, but related to a whole lot of things, is that Apple is moving very quickly, and not necessarily in a way that's healthy for really anybody. Every year there's a new version of OS X, or now Mac OS, as you noted, and it doesn't necessarily seem like it's getting better so much as it's just changing. And we're seeing all sorts of changes and all sorts of things getting rewritten or just started from scratch, but taking the time to shore up the things that were done a year ago and 2 years ago seems to take a back seat. And so I think that, as both a user and a developer, that's something that I have seen where, you know, the new OS comes out and you say, okay, there's some shiny new stuff and that's great, but I really just want my Mac to work. And I'm not so concerned about getting a whole lot of new features.
My readers tell me that.
I think we hear it a lot. It's not just, I don't think it's something that is unique to just me. I think it's something that a lot of people have experienced. And my hope is that Apple hears it too and says, you know what, maybe we slow down a little bit and say, all right, let's take a year and maybe we don't update the OS, or maybe the update is no new features and nothing but bug fixes. But,
you know, there was some concern about the next version, which we now know as Sierra, in that El Capitan was labeled as a maintenance release, cleaning up, debugging, settling it down, not a whole lot of new features. And before WWDC, I lamented that maybe we would go back to this vicious cycle of, you know, a whole bunch of new features that would destabilize the operating system. And I was pleased to see Apple doing what it did with macOS Sierra, in that, you know, they did what they needed to do, which was Siri, thank goodness, and a few other little details, but not loading us up again. So with respect to what we were just talking about, we've had two releases in a row where Apple does seem to be kind of shoring it up in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's definitely something that, you know, we hope to see continue. But at the same time, when El Capitan came out, there were multiple issues that took quite a while to resolve. And so it's something where even if the intent is to fix all sorts of problems. Any change is going to lead to some set of new problems.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just say, you know what, this year we're doing 10.11.6, and there's literally going to be nothing new. It's only going to be fixing what we know is wrong. I think it's a hard sell because there's nothing to market there. You can't go to the public and say, yep, we just fixed a bunch of new bugs and there's no new features. Even though the operating system is free now, no one's going to be excited about that. But at the same time, I would be pleased with it because it would probably mean my Mac was going to work better. And that's really my goal, is to get things done with my Mac and have it function the way that it needs to. So,
well, you know, the other thing, Paul, is I've noticed that even though we are kind of, you know, fidgety about the new OS and the features, as you said, I get the feeling that Apple isn't quite so much in a toe-to-toe competition with Windows anymore. You know, it used to be maybe 5-7 years ago that, you know, we had Redmond get your photocopiers running, and they were trading off and stealing features, and Lion was fighting against Windows 7 or whatever it was.
And I think so, yeah.
So, but I kind of get the feeling that Apple isn't quite so uptight with the popularity of iOS. Doesn't seem to me like there's this pitched competition anymore between OS X and Windows. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think you're exactly right. And I think, you know, you mentioned iOS, and I think they've shifted their battle to iOS versus Android, which, you know, is not necessarily the healthiest thing either, but at least means that hopefully the Mac gets a little bit of a break as far as the major changes that they sometimes do. So I think you're absolutely right, though, that there's not necessarily that sort of head-to-head matchup that they previously had versus Windows. I think they're pretty satisfied with where the Mac is, and they're not concerned about convincing people that they need something new in Mac OS versus Windows.
Right. Now it's all about making life better for us with things like Siri and the remote copy and paste and things like that to just make our lives better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what do you think about this subscription software thing?
This subscription software thing. That's a three-word phrase that could take us a couple hours to discuss, I think.
You got 60 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see how briefly I can address that. I mean, the basic idea of software that you pay for on a monthly basis or an annual basis and you don't actually own has some merits, and I think it has a lot of downsides for people. We've seen it discussed for years and years, and in the past few years, we've seen Adobe and Microsoft do this and do it somewhat successfully. But that's for software that is used by businesses and costs hundreds, if not thousands of dollars. So rather than plunking down, you know, $1,500 for the latest Creative Suite from Adobe, you can pay $50 a month. And if you only need it for 6 months, you end up saving a whole lot of money. And that's obviously beneficial for users. As far as a developer of tools that range from, you know, $30 to $75, I think it's a lot harder sell to convince users that, hey, if you give us $2 to $5 a month, you'll always have the latest version, and it'll enable us to release updates more frequently.
Especially in a system where you're doing podcasting and you may want to maintain configuration control, and you maybe don't want to jump ahead until some other pieces are in place.
That's a big aspect of it, is that I think a lot of people are looking at this and they're saying, you know what, renting is the future. You know, we rent our Netflix and we rent our music on Apple Music, and, you know, nobody buys music anymore. Nobody buys movies anymore. And there's a lot of truth to that. But at the same time, then you hear about things where people purchased what they thought was a product, and it turns out they were actually really just renting it. A big case was, there was a company that Nest had bought that had a product, and it didn't have a whole lot of users, but they're shutting down the web services side of it, and suddenly people have a $300 piece of hardware that doesn't do anything. And come to find out, oh, we were really just renting that. I didn't actually own that service. And I think people have definitely had some negative experiences with that, where they would have been much happier if they just said, you know what, I'm buying something and it works and I own it. And if something goes wrong, I'll deal with it. And if not, it'll work and continue to work no matter what happens to the company that gets acquired or whatever. So it's something where I think we're in very early days with this idea of subscription software and subscriptions in general for different services that used to be just purchase and then you own it. And we're sort of watching how it fleshes out and watching, you know, how various competitors and colleagues do with it and where it makes sense and where it doesn't make sense. So it's certainly something where we're interested in the idea and the idea of getting recurring revenue as opposed to for us, we get when we release a new version, we get a big chunk of money. And over time, it slows a little bit as, you know, the majority of people have already purchased it. And then a couple years later, we say, OK, here's a new version and it's got a whole bunch of new features and we get a whole bunch of upgrade revenue. That's a system that's worked for us for 15 years, 14 years now. And it's worked pretty well. But it's obvious that there are other options out there and subscription software is one of them. So it's right now it's one where we're sort of taking a wait and see approach and we're seeing how users react to it and how it works out for them. But it's certainly something to keep an eye on anyway.
Cool. Well, that's certainly a challenge for any developer to think about and work with. So we're about running out of time. So I wanted to ask you if you have any final thoughts, post WWDC reflections or any other thoughts you wanted to add?
Actually, you asked a question that I had a secondary answer for. You asked, you know, how it was working with Apple and especially after WWDC. Something that was interesting at WWDC that I think didn't get a whole lot of press was that Apple actually opened up iCloud to non-Mac App Store apps. So earlier in the conversation, we were talking about not being in the Mac App Store and, you know, whether that was detrimental. And to me, the fear has long been that Apple is looking to make the Mac like iOS, where the only way you get software is from the App Store. And that hasn't been the case for the first, 30 years of the Mac's life. But it would not necessarily be crazy to think Apple wants to get to that point. And so, 3 weeks ago, Apple released the iCloud functionality. Any app can use that now. You no longer need to be in the Mac App Store, where previously you did. And that's something where we said, all right, that's a good sign. That tells us that, you know, Apple is not looking to get every application into the Mac App Store. If they're okay with our software using iCloud, despite the fact that it's not in the Mac App Store, and they're newly okay with that, it's an indicator to us that, you know, they're not expecting everything to get into the App Store. And so that's certainly, that's something that we've been, you know, we were pleased to see and hopefully is a good indicator for the future of software development in general on the Mac platform.
Cool. Very encouraging. Well, Paul, I think we're going to have to wrap it up. This has been a wide-ranging and fascinating discussion. Thank you for being on the show. And so tell the listeners how they can contact you or Rogue Amoeba if they wish.
You should come to our website at rogueamoeba.com. And if you can't spell it, just Google it and you'll find us. I'm pretty sure we also own audiohijack.com, which is a lot easier to spell. But you can contact us there. We're also on Twitter at rogueamoeba. And check out our software and certainly get in touch about anything that that comes up with using that software.
Excellent. Okay, so listeners, thanks for joining us. This was a delightful show. I hope you enjoyed it too. And thanks for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.